Home Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. It's not shaping up to be a happy holiday season for City of LA employees. Find out why nearly 2,000 jobs could be cut, including almost 1,000 LAPD officers. Plus, remember the movie Selena starring J-Lo? Now there's Selena the Series, a streaming TV show filling in gaps in her story that the film left out. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up. Baila, baila esta cumbia, mueve, mueve la cintura, todos, las manos en alto y grito. The life story of beloved Tejano music star Selena will now be told through a new series on Netflix. We're going to hear from the show's director in about 30 minutes. But first, COVID-19 is hitting local governments really hard, and the city of Los Angeles is no different. A new budget report recommends eliminating over 1,800 city jobs, including nearly 1,000 police officers. KPCC's senior politics reporter Libby Denkman is here to explain it all. Libby, I know we just got this document. It's pretty big, 144 pages. So far into your reporting, though, what's going on with it?
Sure. A city budget analyst just released, it's a second financial status report that they put out for the budget year that begins July 1st. And they outline a dire situation. The city is $675 million in the hole, and that shortfall is likely to widen in the coming months. Tax revenue has not recovered since the start of the pandemic, and spending on COVID response, it's only grown. That includes emergency measures like PPE, testing, everything along those lines. The city cannot make up that gap by cutting around the margins. The biggest expense in the budget is personnel costs, especially salaries. So this proposal calls for program cuts in nearly every department, but also layoffs, including eliminating 951 sworn LAPD jobs, as you mentioned, and cutting over 700 civilian LAPD positions. And ultimately, A, we know from the 2008 recession, those layoffs will mean service cuts. Mm-hmm. City Administrative Officer Rich Llewellyn said in the report that reductions are difficult, but he added that immediate action is critical to addressing the magnitude of this budget gap.
Libby, I know the city has been talking about budget problems since the mayor came out with his first coronavirus era budget. That was in the spring. But how did we get here?
Yes, the fiscal situation has just gone from bad to worse as 2020 has unfolded. The city has already dug deep into its reserves, and it risks damaging its own credit rating if it goes any further into the emergency funding. The CAO previously described the worst case scenario in LA as falling behind $600 million in terms of the city budget. And even at that stage, the mayor said several times that layoffs may be necessary. Now we're at $675 million. So that's the update on out of today's report. In September, Garcetti asked department managers to find savings of 3% across the board and to identify non-critical services and positions that could be eliminated. There have been attempts to save money here and there. Earlier in the year, the mayor announced partial furloughs for civilian workers that would equal about 10% of a pay cut for close to 16,000 people. But those were delayed, until next year, and they're now slated to take effect in January. City leaders are also asking public employee unions to delay planned raises. That includes putting off a pay bump of 2% for civilian workers and over 3% for police officers that are supposed to kick in next month. But the union representing police officers has so far refused to come to the negotiating table on that.
So those 951 officers and over 700 civilian employees, that's a deep cut to the LAPD. What's the reaction from the police union been like so far?
Right. The LAPPL says the proposal is, quote, disgusting and the wrong thing to do when murders are up in the city. LAPD Chief Michael Moore told reporters in a video Q&A this week that further cuts to his department would, quote, be devastating to the safety of the city. Moore added that the increase in the murder rate is mostly due to gang violence. Something to note, I just got off the phone with City Council Member Mike Bonin, who said the LAPPL could mitigate these job cuts if they came to the table to reduce or defer those planned raises. He said that, services, the civilian workers at the LAPD, for example, will also, result in a cut to services and public safety. But this could all be avoided if the union was willing to negotiate on the raises and benefits. But again, the union says that negotiation is just a non-starter. Big picture, the pandemic is stretching the budget to a breaking point. Some emergency expenses will eventually be reimbursed, but for now, the city is on the hook for them. And once CARES Act dollars are exhausted, additional federal funding is not quite on the horizon. NPR News was just talking about Congress negotiating over those. The mayor and the city council are still hoping for a Hail Mary bailout from Congress. But in the meantime, they say deep cuts to services and layoffs are really their only recourse.
Really quick, Libby, what's next on this?
This proposal goes to the council's budget committee on Monday. We're still waiting to hear from the mayor and other council members. And it's sure to be a long and tough debate, eh?
That's KPCC senior politics reporter Libby Denkman. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, now to State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. And today, hopefully, you've stuffed your stockings with hand sanitizer and some TP because there are more safer-at-home orders in store for the holiday season. And which Californian will Governor Gavin Newsom gift with a gently used seat in the U.S. Senate? With us today to break all of this down is Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Hello, Marisa.
How gently used do you think that seat is?
Very gently, actually. She's got a bigger seat to fill in a second. Well, also with us, Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Rafe, welcome.
Good to be with you.
All right, before we get to all of that above, I want to get you guys' take on that ugly budget report we just heard Libby Denkman tell us about. I mean, severe job cuts are going to be coming, especially at the police department. There's not a lot of options here, but how do you think this will play out politically in the coming week? Rafe, let's start with you.
Oh, it's a terrible situation. The city's been in this before after Prop 13 and the 1990s recession and the mid-2000s. It's awful because, as your report from Libby said, the services are given by people, delivered by people at the city level. This is where the rubber meets the road. And it's often a battle between pay levels and employment levels. And the city ends up in these incredibly difficult negotiations in the context of a rising homicide rate and public support at a very organized and important level to reduce the level of policing. So everything that could be a problem for City Hall in terms of policy and politics is on view. The only thing I can tell you is we've been there before and eventually come out of it. But boy, it's no fun for anybody at City Hall, no matter where they're sitting right now.
We've been there before, Rafe, but not like this and not with a virus, being a shadow over us. So I think there are some differences there.
Yeah, although one possibility is if the federal government would do its job, which it has not done this entire year, it should not have left the states and the cities to handle what is a national, global crisis and figure they'll take care of it. Prop 13 had effects that lasted for decades. And with some help from Washington, and I'm hopeful that Congress will do the right thing before December 11th on the budget, there could be some help coming, and maybe next year will be better, but this is an awful, awful situation.
Marisa, what are you seeing in San Francisco when it comes to the budget? I'm curious to hear what that city is experiencing and how it's approaching cuts. Maybe does it have similar priorities to L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, so we saw the city earlier this year facing a $1.5 billion budget deficit, and they were actually able to plug that hole without resorting to service cuts or laying folks off, in part because of a pretty generous restructuring of our business tax code that happened, the voters approved in November. But even with all of that, because of the continued shutdowns, we're facing another $116 million hole. And I got to say, the place where it's really hurting, especially in the Bay Area, is transit. Our municipal transportation agency could lay off as much as 22% of its workforce. That's 1,200 employees next fiscal year. And so, like, I think we're seeing similar challenges at BART, our regional train system. These are, places where there have been the effects of the pandemic have been felt even more strongly, both because of falling revenues, but also just because people aren't riding them as much. And I do think that what we're seeing kind of more broadly is this, things weren't quite as bad statewide as we thought they were going to be, but that doesn't mean they're going to be good in the next year or two, right?
Yeah, and Marisa, let's move on, because it seems like everyone in California is dealing with a shutdown, a lockdown, some kind of restriction. On top of the safer at home orders for LA City and the county, Governor Newsom announced yesterday 5 regions across the state. If a region sees ICU bed capacity that dips below 15%, it'll trigger a 3-week safe at home order. And there's also a possibility that in your neck of the woods that might happen, whether it's at 15% or not. But so, putting your finger to the wind on this, what's the public sentiment to these restrictions?
I mean, I think, unfortunately, this whole pandemic has become so politicized from the get-go, I think largely because of the actions of our president. People who have been skeptical about the reality of this virus, doubt whether it exists, are pushing back. I've already gotten some news releases from Republican strategists who are helping out, you know, small business owners who are really angry that they're going to have to shut down again. But at the end of the day, I think a lot of us feel like we still don't want to get this virus. We don't want to see our hospitals overrun. I mean, we all remember those stories from Italy in the spring. So I don't think there's going to be like a huge revolt. I think that folks on the right, especially who have always been critical of these measures, are going to continue to be, but that the general public is, you know, hoping and waiting for this vaccine, which I think, you know, looks pretty good.
Any truth to the talk that in the Bay Area, some counties are just going to shut down on Sunday before, you know, ICU bed capacities become a problem to try and head it off?
Yeah, so we just got out of a news conference the last hour in which 5 counties, Marin, San Francisco, Alameda, Contra Costa, all said, we're just going to do it now, even though the governor gives us a few weeks before we hit that measure. I think in part, we've been more aggressive in the Bay Area since the get-go. We had a shutdown order before the state one. I also think that they're looking at the sort of landscape across the state and thinking about the fact that, you know, if every other region is already at that critical capacity of ICU beds, it's not actually great for us to get there too, because we might be able to help other regions if we can. So the only confusing thing is, I'll say, everyone's doing it slightly differently. So it's sometime between Sunday and Tuesday, depending on where you live, that this is going to take effect.
Rafe, we talked on the show yesterday about assessing the moral authority of some politicians. That's because several of them, including the governor, have said one thing about what's not safe, such as like dining with others and then doing it themselves. And it's even extending past California. The mayor of Austin, Texas, posted a video a while ago about not traveling, and he posted it from a vacation in Cabo San Lucas. So it's been a little bit frustrating for a lot of people. What are you learning in real time about the way our leaders have been communicating things?
Well, that's a different question about how they've been communicating about the virus. This I think, is a bit of an overblown story. On the other hand, I have to tell you that hypocrisies in relatively small things always get much more interest than gigantic, catastrophic mistakes that cost thousands of lives, tens of thousands of lives. You'd have to think that all these elected officials would have somebody in their office who would say, boss, don't do that. I saw it on your calendar. Just, you know, don't do it. And some of it is just goofy and just maybe the result of exhaustion or who knows what. I do think these people have all been working really hard at the state and local level while people in Washington have been sitting on their hands. So it's kind of a little hard for me to paint them as evil. But, you know, really, why would you give your critics a hammer to hit you over the head with?
Yeah, I don't know about, I wouldn't go evil either, Rafe. It's just simple mistake, like slipping on a banana peel that you can see coming a mile away. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, and the simplest rule in politics is say, I made a fool of myself. I can't believe I did it, which probably the governor came the closest to of any of the people dealing with. There really is no explanation for it that's worth really anything at all. Just, you know, I'm tired. I'm a fool. I don't know why I did it. I'll never do it again. I'm going to get back to work now. And I'll be in office for a couple of years, and hopefully everyone will forget about this and forgive me.
Marisa, on the latest episode of Political Breakdown, you talked with Dr. Anthony Fauci, and he said that a statewide stay-at-home order is prudent, but agreed with a question you had about the mixed messaging from our lawmakers. Let's hear that.
Yeah, said another way, mixed messages are bad. Okay, so that's the short answer to what you're saying. You're right. One of the problems inherent in mixed messages is that provides license for people to do things according to their own preconceived notions. Because if they hear that going left is right, going right is right, then they say, I'm going to go wherever I want to go because it's a 50-50 chance. That's not good.
Well, Marisa, Dr. Fauci sounds very energetic, like he's got a new lease on life or something like that.
maybe a new president, perhaps, new boss.
Yeah. So what did he have to say about trying to craft a united message?
Well, I mean, he actually had pretty complimentary things to say about the way California has handled this. And he acknowledged, you know, we are a state of almost 40 million people with very diverse regions. I think in some ways we were talking more broadly about the mixed messaging from the top in Washington, quite frankly, and our president. But I think this has been a challenge. I think people are just confused because it's so complicated. And I think this is one of the things the governor's office and local health officials continue to struggle with. And I don't think they're always succeeding, which is how do you make this sort of nuanced and you know, responsive to what's happening without making it so confusing people don't know what to do. So if you look at the website the governor's office put up with FAQs about this new shutdown, it's long and there's a lot of, you know, what is allowed? Can I go outside and hang out with my friends with a mask? I mean, I think they're trying, but I'm not sure we're always succeeding. And I think Fauci understands that and is trying his best to be clear and consistent. But, you know, there's been so many messengers that it's been problematic for sure.
Marisa Rafe, hang out. More Take Two, more State of Affairs coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. We're talking State of Affairs with Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA, and also with us Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Rafe, we just heard Marisa talk with Dr. Anthony Fauci about messaging. I wanted to get your take on what he said there. You know, when it comes to mixed messaging, that obviously creates maybe a trust gap. What's at stake in this moment if the public, say, doesn't believe or doesn't understand or doesn't even want to listen because of a trust being violated?
Can I first say how amazing it is to see Fauci unbound? I mean,
wait, how about this? Fauci unfettered.
And, you know,
that sounds better.
Like an S on his shirt. You know, I mean, he's come out of nowhere. He's been offered a position in the new administration that he'll be have a leading role. And he really is something. He's a phenomenon. I want to say something for the people who have been complying since March, because we don't talk about them much. We only talk about winning the trust of those who don't want to comply. And I'm here to tell you, that's not going to happen. If they don't want to comply, there's no level of communication that will probably work. They've tried just about everything. But when you're walking down the street with a mask on and you're passed by three people without a mask, maybe you feel like you had a ration card in World War II and you've just got a little bit of flour in your bag and somebody walks by with six turkeys and is not sort of pulling their weight along, there has to be a message for people that it was worth it to do all this. And I think right now with the numbers going up, that's where there's a lot of despair happening. I think people will comply who are trying to do the right thing. But helping them to comply may be more valuable than trying to persuade those who just don't want to have anything to do with this common endeavor.
That's something that, you know, Rafe, I think I've been wrestling with, and I think a lot of people have been wrestling with. Has this been worth it to not see my 96-year-old grandmother? Has it been worth it not to see my uncles and aunts in Koreatown and just staying away from the place I grew up, the house that I grew up in back in the 70s? That's been the tough part to kind of wrestle with.
But it has been worth it. And maybe a message, like a meta message that leaders haven't been doing, is instead of always telling us what the list is of what we can and can't do, say, folks, we're almost there. We're not far away. You have not wasted your compliance all these months.
Now,
Fauci talks about that a lot. And I think Newsom has actually done a good job of talking about that, too. But I mean, he is very hopeful. And I think we need to keep that in mind right now. Like, the light is at the end of the tunnel. It's just we're still in the darkness.
Marisa, speaking of our leaders, Congress is finally back to negotiations on a stimulus package to help people during this time. And magic number right now is $908 billion. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell both walked out of a meeting on this with some optimism. So where does all of this stand and what's on the table that could help people here?
First of all, can I just say I would love to be a fly on the wall to see how those two interact with each other in a closed room. I really have no idea.
Or a fly on the VP's head.
So, you know, this is obviously a big concession by Democrats who have wanted something three, four times this size. I think that what they're seeing now is this, that things are really bad. It seems like the politics that McConnell and others in the Senate Republican caucus were playing pre-election, they're sort of willing to put aside here. And I think the way Pelosi probably views this, because of what Joe Biden has been talking about, is a first step. And so I think there is hope that we could get something done by the end of the year. I think that would obviously, you know, all the conversations we just had about local budgets, maybe that could help. I think the bigger thing is the unemployment and whether folks are going to just see this dry up. But rest assured, whether or not, you know, Democrats take back the Senate in Georgia via Georgia, I think Biden is going to come in with a pretty robust economic plan that's going to include probably billions more in stimulus.
You know, not so long ago, many Democrats, Pelosi included, were not too keen on agreeing on a relief bill below $2 trillion. Meanwhile, Americans waited while all of this was playing out in Congress. So today, Nancy Pelosi was asked if she made a mistake by not making a deal a lot earlier.
Don't characterize what we did before as a mistake, as a preface to your question, if you want an answer. That was not a mistake. It was a decision, and it has taken us to a place where we can do the right thing without other, shall we say, considerations in the legislation that we don't want.
This is for both of you. Considering the economic circumstances of the pandemic, how do you guys judge the political calculus that's got us to where we are on the stimulus package? Rafe, you first.
I think it all has to do with January 5th, the election in Georgia, which is the combination of the rising numbers have attracted the interest of Republicans that they don't want to be characterized as holding up this relief aid. And there's going to be some pretty horrible stories at the end of December. So I think McConnell's at the table because he wants to not be subject to the argument that the Democrats need the Senate in order to get any relief to people. Democrats need to be at the table because they don't want Joe Biden to come in with a depression as opposed to a massive recession. And they need something. They need anything to be helpful. The Democrats really want aid to states and cities. Republicans don't want to do that. If Democrats win on that and don't give up too much on liability protection for companies on the virus, they'll probably feel like they got something and the Republicans will feel. Now, I also will tell you nothing really interesting happens until the day before the deadline on December 11th when the government's supposed to close down. But really, maybe the deadline's the end of the month for all we know because they can always extend things. But January 5th is looming. The control of the Senate is at stake right now.
Marisa, you were going to get the last word. I'm out of time.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. Marisa Lagos.
I talk plenty.
Marisa Lagos, correspondent for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, also co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA. Rafe, Marisa, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
You too.
You too.
All right, moving on. Earlier this week, California released an ambitious 10-year plan that could reshape programs for young children. We're talking about things such as paid family leave and universal preschool. But what seems to be missing from the plan is a concrete way to pay for all of this. All the new programs together could cost the state an additional $12 billion. KPCC's Mariana Dale has been trying to figure this out all week, and she's here now. Mariana, can you explain how the plan is supposed to be funded?
Well, this is an important question, and it's one that was definitely shared by the people in the early childhood community that I was talking to this week.
Great roadmap, but now let's show us the money.
That was the reaction from Ted Lempert. He's the president of the advocacy group Children Now. And I think the reason that people had these high expectations is that Governor Gavin Newsom has been talking about early childhood issues since before he was even elected. And in his very first budget, he said we were going to get this amazing plan, going to give a state a roadmap to fix all these longstanding issues. Some of those are the fact that providers who are often women of color make poverty level wages and that many families can't access or afford high quality childcare. And the plan does have some strategies to address these issues, and they all tie into four main goals. That's improving access to early care and education programs, untangling the bureaucracy that manages the programs, updating standards, training the workforce, and changing how the state pays providers.
Mariana, how are those ideas connected to that price tag, $12 billion?
Yeah, and that's just an estimate. There's actually a range that it could cost an additional $2 billion to $12 billion that would be, quote, supported through public investments, business contributions, philanthropy, and family fees. And this is me again, but that's a big range.
No, it's big. So it's big.
Yeah. We asked Governor Newsom's office for more details, and I got a response via email from Communications Director Jesse Melger. He wrote to us and he said that there's a range because, quote, or there's a range in the plan, quote, because the policy measures can be achieved through different policy choices and are likely to be phased in over time, end quote. And so I interpret that to mean that this cost depends on what gets funded when. Something like free preschool for all four-year-olds is going to cost way more than changing how families apply for a program, for example. And then that timeline again, it's 10 years to try and get all this stuff done.
10 years. So what are the next steps?
Funny you should ask. That question came up during a virtual briefing yesterday that was held to explain the plan. And this was part of the answer from one of the plan's authors, Janelle Kubinick.
I think, you know, this is to us in some ways a journey to a place of starting.
Yeah, and that stuck out to me because I think it really illustrated that there's a little bit of a mismatch between what people expected from the plan and then what was actually delivered. And the context here is that there's been decades of history where state leaders say, hey, this childcare and early education experience people have is not ideal. They come up with a lot of ways to try and fix it, and then nothing happens. And so I think people really wanted to see action more than they wanted to see a plan.
You know, in January, the governor will present his budget proposal. Do you think we can expect to see parts of the plan there or in bills in the legislature next year?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I did talk to a few lawmakers who've been engaged in these early childhood issues in the past. One of them is Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon. He convened a group of childcare providers, educators, parents, and they came up with their own recommendations. That came out last year.
This is probably not something that politicians say very often, but these programs are expensive. They save money in the long term, but the upfront costs are expensive.
So he's being pretty honest there. It is expensive, but he said despite that cost, he thinks these are important investments to make, and he's going to have his work cut out for him along with other lawmakers because we still don't know the full economic impact of the pandemic. If you remember the most recent budget, $54 billion deficit, and that definitely didn't exist when they were first envisioning this plan.
That's KPCC's Mariana Dale. Mariana, we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you.
More Take Two coming up. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and most anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm E. Martinez. The short life of Tejano music star Selena Quintanilla was immortalized in the 1997 film Selena, released 2 years after she was shot and killed by the former manager of her fan club. That was just a couple of weeks before her 24th birthday. Selena's life and musical journey, which were tragically cut short, still hold people's fascination. Enough so that a new take on her life is set to hit the streaming TV screens. Here to tell us about the new series is Mexican filmmaker Hiromi Kamata. She directed 6 episodes and is an executive producer of Selena, the series. So let's start with Selena Quintanilla's legacy. What can you tell us about what sort of superstar Selena was when she was killed in 1995?
She was at the peak of her career in the Spanish-speaking language world, I would say. She had just achieved her dream, which was to cross over and have an English record album. So she unfortunately left us when she was about to give us even more than she had already given. I believe personally that even now there hasn't been a Latin artist with her strength, with her power, and that has inspired so many of us people from the Latinx community. And, you know, even J-Lo says it she was a landmark on her career, and I think she will continue to inspire us all and hopefully inspire a new generation of Latinx young people who dare to dream big and work hard. to achieve it.
Yeah, and that makes her story so tragic, but it also makes it, I'm assuming, attractive for a filmmaker, for someone that tells stories, because it's so tragic, right? She was about to release Dreaming of You, the album that that really just took her to legend status. A lot of hits on that album, and as you said, she was about to cross over into English music. When it comes to her significance to you, what did her music, what did she mean to you?
I grew up in Mexico. I was born and raised in Mexico. As a Mexican, you know, you grow up with listening to Selena. You go to a wedding, you go to a quinceañeros, you go to a baptism, a karaoke, you know, you just listen to Selena. I have humiliated myself in karaoke many times singing to Selena. I have danced her song until sunrise, you know. So the fact that I had the privilege and blessing of telling her story was something that I could have never imagined, honestly. And I really genuinely love Selena, and I've been a fan ever since I was 10 years old.
Now, you mentioned Jennifer Lopez earlier. Her career took off when she played Selena in the film back in 1997. Let's listen to Jennifer Lopez's reaction to the new Netflix series. This was via an Instagram post from the Netflix series profile.
You know, playing Selena was kind of a landmark moment in my career, and I was so excited when I saw the trailer and heard about it. It's a great way for this generation to get to know Selena.
So, Hiromi, you know that when people watch this series, before they turn it on, they're going to have the movie in the back of their heads, if not at the front of their heads, almost comparing the two. So how did you go about casting the person that played Selena for this series? What did you have in mind? What did you want to avoid? Because Jennifer Lopez's portrayal has lasted really a quarter of a century. It's been so good.
Yeah, I mean, it would be naive to think that there was not going to be a comparison. Obviously, I am a huge fan of the film. I skipped school that day in junior high school and went to the cinema and watched it. You know, that's how much I love it. And to me, it's untouchable and immaculate. I'm a huge fan of Mr. Gregory Navas' film and his work, obviously. So I really wanted to start on a fresh start. You know, just I didn't go back to the movie. I didn't watch it.
You didn't.
No, I did not. What I did was travel to Corpus Christi, hang out, you know, everywhere she used to go, outside her house, her favorite restaurant. Rico Martinez, our wonderful executive producer, helped me with this, you know, very thorough guide of what her life was like and her favorite places. I traveled there with my production designer, with our location manager, and we just, you know, spent some days there as tourists, hanging out where she was, seeing, you know, I wanted to understand the texture, you know, the atmosphere of where she grew up, and also, you know, try to get my hands on every piece of information that our creator Moises Zamora and his team, they had this very thorough, impressive archive of her. So between those two things, I kind of just started imagining, you know.
What did you and your team set out to do with this series, with this television series that was different from the movie?
Well, explore the whole family, the family story, you know, where obviously her story, but also her family. It's a very important part of her and her career. Like, she made music because of her dad, because of her family, because of the Dinos. So going backwards and you know, and also in this canvas of a Mexican American family, you know, like seeing what being a Mexican American family was back in the 80s in the south of Texas. You know, their struggles, their sacrifices, you know, their dreams, you know, how they reacted to situations that happened to them, how they felt trying to fit into a certain society. All that part, I think, is kind of where we wanted to explore. You know, obviously, the lead character is Selena, and she's the universe where all this family drama is depicted. But aside from the film, for example, like, we go deep dive in every stage of her life, like the 80s, for example. No, the 80s is part of her career that wasn't really explored at all in the movie. And here we really dedicate a big part of the series into how did she become Selena? You know, that haunted me, because we think of her and we think of this beautiful, powerful star in a white bustier, you know, or with this purple outfit at the Astrodome. But where did all that came from, and how did she become that? because she, you know, it's not like she was born being that. And there are all these stages, you know, in life as a teenager, your first love, your, all that part of Selena's life, I really wanted to explore. And these scripts gave me that freedom, you know, to go back to even, you know, when you had that funny hair in the 80s or, you know, the big shoulder pads, all these weird outfits that one wore. I mean, we didn't get to see that in the movie. We didn't get to see all these, like, we saw the beautiful butterfly, of course, but she was a caterpillar.
Now, the series also touches on what it means to be a woman, a Latina, a Mexican-American in the music industry and also in the public eye. Here's Selena talking to singer and fellow award nominee Laura Canales at the Tejano Music Awards.
And I just wanted to say thank you.
You just did.
I mean, for going first. Making the road easier for a girl singer.
Easier, maybe. But never easy.
Oh, do you have any advice? Is that okay?
Everyone in this business is gonna tell you who you need to be every step of the way. From what I've seen of you, you should always do everything possible to be who you are.
Again, Hiromi, this is, for me, highlighting the advantages of having the room in a TV series to explore this. This is something we didn't see in the film. But why was this something that you wanted to highlight about Selena's journey?
Well, because it's, to me, something that moved me a lot personally. You know, growing up Japanese in Mexico, I remember as a kid, I tried to hide my Japanese side. No, Selena wanted all her life to sing in English. She wanted to be the next Madonna, the next Jody Watley. And, you know, doors were kept shutting on her face because she looked Mexican, because she wasn't the profile of a pop female singer. And as she embraced Spanish, as she embraced, you know, her Tejano heritage, that's how she empowered herself. And that's how she rose into stardom, by being who she was, by embracing, you know, both her cultures and the fact of being different. So as a woman, you know, who is a Mexican Japanese who went through the same. And I always believe that we as filmmakers are responsible for what we put out there. I think it's a powerful message to put out there for young women and girls, no? And it's something that I would have definitely liked to see when I was growing up.
You know, here in LA, there are 7 murals around town of Selena. So clearly a deep love for her has endured in the 25 years since her tragic death. What do you think accounts for this lasting love that her fans have for her?
First of all, I personally, being a fan of Selena, I think she was a restless spirit. You know, she was a force to be reckoned with. She was unique, authentic, funny, full of passion, with a beautiful singing voice, a big American dream, no? And as a Mexican down here in Mexico back in the 90s, like, to see a Latina winning a Grammy, you know, was like something that impressed us all. And she was achieving the dream that many of us had back then, and a role model. And I think she embodies all that. She embodies the Mexican-American dream becoming true. So that remained in our hearts, aside from the fact that she was a beautiful soul, full of talent. She did it in a way, you know, she did it. If she did it, then she could inspire us all to try and work our butts off to make it too.
That's Hiromi Kamata, director and an executive producer of Selena, the series. Hiromi, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, believe it or not, there are fun things to do this weekend, despite possibly being under a little bit more of a restrictive lockdown kind of weekend. We'll tell you what they are when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on Apple Podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. Yesterday, Warner Brothers, the studio behind the upcoming Wonder Woman 1984 and Dune, said that all of its 2021 movies will premiere on the HBO Max streaming site and also in theaters at the same exact time. And that bombshell announcement was another devastating blow to movie theater owners. But what about theaters where stage productions have been shut down? Well, one local theater company has found huge success with a magic show, and they're going to try it again this weekend. KPC's John Horn has a story.
In normal times, when you go to the theater, the crowded lobby usually sounds a little like this. But the pre-show gathering for a show at the Geffen Playhouse these days sounds more like this. Okay, to magic.
To magic.
Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, everyone, all of my fun friends and my furry friends. I see a couple of dogs in the room. Welcome to our show.
That's my wife and I before the last Geffen show, and that chipper voice is the theater's house manager as she welcomed the audience to the virtual lobby. Like a lot of smaller arts organizations trying to adapt to the pandemic, the Geffen is meeting people where they are these days. On Zoom.
Alrighty. Looks like I can see everyone and you all look amazing, which means that this interactive show is going to go off without a hitch.
That show was called The Present, sort of for two reasons. One, because they sent every household in attendance a mystery box or present for the interactive part of the show. And two, because of the unusual present circumstances that we're living through.
What we are living through now will always be part of our story. And we can't make sense of it yet because we are in the middle of it.
The Present was conceived by and starred Portuguese performer and magician Elder Guimarães.
How we act, how we connect with each other at this moment, that is going to be the meaning of our story.
It turns out that the kind of magic that Guimarães loves, intimate sleight of hand feats coupled with elaborate personal stories, works really well when you're watching on a computer or a TV screen. The Present was a huge success. It opened in May and was extended three times. And by the time it ended in October, Guimarães had given more than 250 performances, and the show had grossed about $850,000, according to the Geffen's executive director, Gil Cates Jr. This weekend, Guimarães' follow-up show, The Future, opens at the Geffen. The theater says it'll involve stories of a high-stakes poker game and the seedy underbelly of the gambling world.
I believe that one of the key discoveries with the show we already done, The Present, is this idea that people receive objects in their houses to do the magic to themselves. Because that's what allows them to feel they are with me and they feel that they are with each other.
A few weeks ago, I met with Guimarães and the director of both of his shows, Frank Marshall. We were at the Geffen Playhouse wearing masks and socially distanced, and the whole place was oddly quiet. There's no hammering from the scene shop, no rehearsals in its theaters. In a few days, though, that lobby would look more like a mini Amazon fulfillment center, as theater staff would be preparing those mystery shipments for the future. Marshall might seem like an odd partner in the show. He's a veteran Hollywood producer with huge blockbuster action movies like the Jason Bourne and Jurassic Park franchises. So why does this guy gravitate to this idiosyncratic magician?
He starts with the story. This is why I love working with him and what attracted me when we first met. It's not a magic show. It's storytelling. Woven in are these magical moments.
The key for Marshall was figuring out how they'd actually capture the shows. It's not as simple as Guimarães firing up his laptop and launching Zoom. They wanted to use a professional camera and never cut away.
One of the things that was a very easy decision for us, and Frank can back me up, it was the idea that we want to make sure that you're going to have the same experience you're going to have in a theater. You know, like, we're going to use the camera to help you have that experience. But we don't want to take the camera as an excuse, or we don't want to use the camera to create things we couldn't do in a live setting. We want to use the camera to enhance your experience at home, like if you were in a theatrical setting.
But we also didn't want to just put up a GoPro and record the show. We wanted to help the audience see what was happening and see the incredible magic that was going on.
So how would they shoot Guimarães in the safety of his own apartment? And how could audiences get close enough to see the playing cards on a table in front of Guimara's. It turned out the solution wasn't far away.
So I said, well, how are we going to do this, guys? And Helder said, well, Katharina's here.
And this is your fiance, right?
This is Helder's fiance. We sent a camera over, and thank goodness she has an eye. It was a blessing. And so then in our first previews, I was on a telephone line, which Katharina had in her ear, and Helder was doing the show, and I was watching from my computer, and I was telling her, okay, zoom in a bit, zoom back a bit. And to be honest, sometimes I forgot to mute, so Helder would always hear me say, zoom in. So it was this kind of comedy for about 2 weeks. Once she got it, for the next 240 shows, it was perfect every time.
The other test was how to bring the audience into the performance. And the answer came in those mystery boxes. Marshall and Guimaraes want to maintain the mystique, so they won't tell me what audiences will get for the interactive aspect of the new show. All they'd say is that it will arrive in a mystery canister, bigger than a box. But for the present, they included a word search puzzle and a deck of playing cards. Guimaraes used the cards to lead viewers through a feat involving pieces of torn-up cards that are repeatedly shuffled and then somehow match right up to form the original cards. Months later, I still have zero idea how that happened. And that is a huge part of the joy, this strange collective sense of discovery and intimacy and participation that you really don't feel in a theater that often, and you pretty much never get on a Zoom call.
My favorite moment is watching the 24 people and watching their wonder when they were doing the magic themselves. There were 80 minutes when they forgot about what the world was. They escaped, which is what we love to do in movies and in the theater, and there was some hope at the end.
And the best thing? Well, there's no sitting in traffic for the drive home. For KPCC, I'm John Horn.
Finally, we have more ideas on what to do this weekend to help you pass some time safely.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And A. Martinez, another week, another safer at home order. So yep. For playing it safe while mixing up what to do at home so you still have a good weekend, we have ideas for you.
All right. First, Leo, got something that could put me in the holiday spirit.
So aside from binging on all the sugar cookies you can find, you can enjoy everyone's favorite angel, Dolly Parton.
Oh.
So tonight at 6 o'clock, she's hosting a holiday special that features country music stars like Tasha Cobb-Leonard, a pre-show trivia, a virtual photo booth, and more. This event is streaming online. You just have to RSVP, and it's free. Also, by the way, if you miss it, she's apparently doing a ton of holiday specials because she's the person that just keeps on giving this season.
Before I left for work, Leo, I asked my wife what she's going to do today, and she said, fixing to watch Dolly tonight.
So, Dolly Parton's America's Sweetheart. Yeah.
All right, so, okay, what about something to do that'll make me feel good for giving back?
All right, so getting very serious, safer at home orders are easier to follow if you have a home. But you should be reminded that Los Angeles has a sizable population of people who are homeless, including youth out there struggling to stay safe. So tomorrow morning, you can do some good by doing a virtual 5K. It's hosted by the organization Safe Place for Youth. And after this group virtual stretch session at 10 a.m., you can run or walk the 5 kilometers in and around your own neighborhood. The entry fee starts at $25, and the money you help raise supports the work of Safe Place for Youth.
All right, finally, Leo, what's something to help me feel social in the absence of a holiday party?
So aside from getting drunk in your own home on eggnog, which doesn't sound that much fun.
No.
Yeah. So earlier in the show, we heard about the new Netflix series, Selena. So tomorrow night, you can actually have dinner and the show courtesy of the LA Times. So here's the deal. It's part of their program where you can sign up and you'll get a Tex-Mex dinner from the restaurant Socolo in Santa Monica, and then join an online conversation with the cast and creator of the series. This way you get some behind-the-scenes insight into the show, aka gossip. So make it a date night. Tickets are $95, and that starts at 6:30 tomorrow. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to online. You can find out what you can do this weekend by heading to our site, laist.com. That is laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat. I'll be mostly hanging out with my cat this weekend, as I have been for the past 9 months.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
Cool. Thanks, eh?
You know, I gotta say that today's show was arguably in the top five of the shows that we have done this week. Arguably in the top five, you know. If you want to go back and listen to any of them, I've got some great interviews this week. Kevin De Leon on the LA City Council about those homes in El Sereno. Also more about Selena the series debuting today on Netflix. Just go to wherever you get your podcast there. We will be waiting to be heard by you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.